Afternoon, we'll call to order the House Committee on Business and Labor. Welcome, everybody. We have three bills up for public hearing only today. And we're going to start actually with the third bill on the list, House Bill 4053. And Representative Thompson is here to, as the sponsor of the bill, to kick off the testimony. Please come up. You want to describe the bill?
If you wish, Mr. Chair.
The staff will give us an overview of the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4053 modifies the types of animals that qualify as assistance animals for purposes of assisting places of public accommodation and the modes of transportation and for purposes of cause of action for harm to assistance animal. There's an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Co-Chair Garrett and Co-Chair Esquivel, thank you for hearing this bill.
Would you reprimand him?
This guy's.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's been a long day.
Okay. Yes, and you deserve that faux pas. Last time was plenty. I agree with you. But I couldn't pass it up either because I endured the committee with you.
I didn't want your vote anyway.
So. Don't need it.
Well, at least we understand each other. Thank you.
For the record, so everybody will know who just did that, State Representative Jim Thompson, House District 23. House Bill 4053 is an attempt to fix a problem that's been going on for some time. And as is usually the case with very simple, straightforward bills, they become fraught with other things. The intention of this bill is to define service animals in line with federal statute to be essentially dogs for the purpose of going into places of business like grocery stores, restaurants, etc. And we were hoping to fix a problem. That being, we have left this completely wide open, and you're going to hear testimony from retailers behind me, so I'm going to be very brief, that people are bringing animals into grocery stores and restaurants that I deem, and I think they will probably back me up, are inappropriate for that environment and cause problems. An issue has arisen about whether or not this applies to housing issues. I understand an amendment is being prepared to clarify that it will not apply to housing. We want it to stay just into this retail access realm. And just briefly, an example that happened in my district, this has been a couple of years ago, a gentleman came into a small rural grocery store with a yellow boa around his neck that is differently described as either being 5 feet or 9 to 10 feet long. Now, one of them's wrong, but it was a bigger snake than one would normally carry in their pocket. And the manager approached him. I could write this into comedy, but it wasn't funny at the time. The manager approached him, did not speak good English, and was trying in animated fashion to get him to leave the store with the snake because two elderly ladies were in there and began screaming. One of them was terrified of snakes, the other one just didn't like them. He refused to leave the store because he has a right, because this is a psychological support animal that he needs. So as that was going on, the two women ran to the back of the store and continued screaming. Another gentleman comes in, sees what's going on, and he tries to escort the gentleman with the snake out of the store, who is protesting loudly that he has a right to have that snake with him at all times. It's his psychological support animal. And in the meantime, the snake becomes agitated and bites its owner, which caused a medical situation. Having a frantic store manager, the 77-year-old lady of the two wet her pants and passed out into...
Maybe we need a few less details.
Well, this is what we're up against, guys. This isn't
wow.
The point.
Is this
but anyway, she collapsed literally into a puddle. No one knew she had a heart attack or what happened. Now we have another kind of medical emergency on our hands. And I question whether or not a person who has a snake, as a psychological support animal, has the right to take that into particularly a grocery store or a restaurant or some other place where it is insensitive toward other patrons that are there. And a lot of people have very, very severe fear of snakes, as an example. And I think, as you'll hear in testimony behind me, this has involved rats in produce departments, parrots flying around stores, and a lot of other disruption. So it is the intent of this bill to address just that piece of the issue, that people should not bring their zoo into the grocery store, whatever their reason, but it would allow dogs, which is we believe is consistent with federal law. And I could go on and on, but I think you get the point.
Thank you, Representative. So grocery stores and restaurants have the obvious in common, which is that they involve food, public health, et cetera. Right. Are you intending that it would go beyond those two types of establishments to basically any kind of public accommodation? Or what was the intent in terms of how limiting we were going to be on this?
At this point, I think it would be better to move on to the other testimony, because I didn't intend it was going to be such a big deal in the first place, and I certainly didn't intend that housing was going to be involved until we had people arrive in our office from Boley, et cetera, et cetera. So it is an issue that we have to define, and I'm not sure the bill actually defines it as narrowly or broadly, but we want to cover a situation as best as we can.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for? Maybe we shouldn't allow any questions.
Can I have one clarifying?
Yes.
And so with this, ADA defines a service animal as a dog?
Yeah. Okay. We're not, this isn't a bill that's trying to take after the handicapped or any of those issues. It's a bill to level the playing field for everybody that has to deal with this in a fair and accommodating manner. I mean, perhaps if you have a large brown rat, you might want to leave it in your car while you go in the grocery store and then pick it up on the way out. I'm sure there's other ways of dealing with this other than a rat running through the produce department. So that's the issue we're trying to address.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've all seen abuse of this in grocery stores and restaurants. I think Vicky Berger, Representative Berger, summed it up very well. Personally, I like dogs. I don't know if she does or not. I think she does. But she said, you know, you may love your dog, but it doesn't mean that I do.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's what we're talking about here. Because I've seen dogs in women's purses, at Sizzler,
Bite the Band,
in restaurants, and I've seen dogs running through grocery stores. And, you know, if you're buying food and produce, I don't especially want a dog running through there. So
some of that, I understand, is enshrined in federal law, and we probably are not going to have much effect on changing that at the state level. But we certainly can, I believe, clarify and narrow the scope of what we're doing.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dalmatian, right?
No, I understand what you're doing with the bill and what you're trying to do for dogs. And if I have a honey badger, I can leave him in the car and he won't care. But my question is, would this address like therapy dogs? And I ask you that because some people view the therapy dog as a service animal. Is that something that somebody else might want?
Mention of this, and you'll get more testimony behind me, is to narrow the focus to what's allowed in federal law and conform to that. I believe therapy dogs would probably be allowed, but I don't know that for certain.
Okay.
Thank you for indulging. It depends on what the word therapy means in this context, but there's no intention to try to move out specially trained dogs for special functions, and they generally are trained to be quiet, accommodating, and not scare the holy daylights out of anybody. And especially, they don't do things in the produce. So,
thank you, Representative. I think we can release you.
I'm so pleased you have this bill.
We are too. Thank you.
We have some in health care. I'll bring over to you.
Yeah.
No, thanks, Jim.
Let's see. We'll hear next from Sean Miller, Melinda Merrill, and Jim Gardner, please.
A
co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller, here today on behalf of Northwest Grocery Association in support of House Bill 4053. Representative Thompson did a good job summarizing the bill. I just wanted to comment on a few questions that were brought up during that testimony. Questions were asked about the ADA and the Department of Federal Department of Justice interpretation of the ADA, and that definition defines service animal, and this gets to Representative Doherty's question, meaning a dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks for benefit of an individual with a disability. And I think to get further into Representative Matthews' question, including a physical, sensory, psychiatric, intellectual, and other mental disability. And so again, we are using the bill and narrowing what those animals are to dogs, and by federal definition, it goes on to further say miniature horses is considered a service animal in some circumstances. So as you can see in the bill, we have to, by federal law, have to address dogs and miniature horses. So the Northwest Grocery Association introduced this bill up in Washington State in 2011, passed nearly unanimous. We're bringing it down here to Representative Garrett's co-chair's question regarding public accommodation on line 28 of the page. It is written quite broad in the draft. That's not our intent. And our intent is to mirror the Washington law, which addresses businesses where food for human consumption is sold or served. So again, it limits it specifically to restaurants and grocery stores in those circumstances. So with that, Mr. Co-Chairs, I think I'd like to turn it over to Melinda Merrill with Fred Meyer to actually talk about the circumstances that we're encountering. And I believe you will find that the animals that she's going to mention is not appropriate in the grocery aisles of our grocery stores.
What was the language from the Washington statute again that you quoted?
It is food, businesses where food for human consumption is sold or served. And we don't have the amendment back from Legislative Council. Mr. Gardner will talk about that, but that has been submitted. That is our intent of the bill, and we will hopefully come back with narrowing the scope of this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clearly way too broad in this.
Thank we agree.
Okay.
Ms. Merrill.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Kennemer, members of the committee, thank you for taking this time today. I'm Melinda Merrill. I'm Director of Public Affairs for Fred Meyer Stores based in Portland. And I first want to make sure everyone knows that we don't like to ask customers to leave our store. We don't like to have anyone have a bad shopping experience. We don't want to have scenes in our stores. We do everything we can to accommodate the huge variety of customers we get in our stores. But this is not the kinds of stories that you have heard, or that you just heard, and that I'll tell you, are not rare occurrences. This kind of thing happens every single day in our stores. We have 50 stores in Oregon. It happens every single day. I sent a note out to our store directors before I came here today. We have to our 50 directors. They have, in addition to the dogs and the puppies that I think we've all probably seen at one time in the stores, cats that ride on the shoulder like a bird. Rats, one saw a mouse perched on the handle of the grocery cart. Ferrets, snakes around the neck. Spiders, like big tarantula size on the shoulders. Hamsters and gerbils. Monkeys, and that came from more than one director, so multiple monkeys in the stores. Lizards. Parrots. Multiple directors talked about parrots that, for lack of a better word, poop down the back while the customer's walking through the store. And then the dogs, of course, I actually have some personal experience with trained assistance dogs. And unless they've caught a bug or something, they're not going to make leave a mess in public. And the dogs that we have in our stores leave messes in public. And when they do that, they have to be cleaned up by someone with hazmat training. You can't just get your, 16-year-old parcel that's grabbing carts and usually cleans up spills to be the one that cleans that up. It's considered a hazmat spill. So there's two big issues with this. And the first one is the response I got from our store directors was that this is the most difficult kind of customer to deal with. It creates the most difficult situations of any other issue they have in the stores. They want to be with their pets. I don't know if maybe they know that we don't have to let them stay there. So it's instantly defensive. It's instantly angry when they're approached by a store director or manager and asked if it's an assistant animal. It creates an instant ugly situation. And our security personnel have to be called, and the directors and managers that get threatened with kicking and hitting, and one actually was spit on. So it's not just the inappropriateness of these animals in the stores, but for some reason there's a general defensiveness as soon as you're asked if it's an assistance animal, and it's an immediate difficult situation that manager knows he or she has to face every day. So I do appreciate you taking the time for this. It is a really, really important first step. I want to mention one other really important step that I hope can be considered somewhere along the line, either in this legislation or some other time, and that's the dogs in the carts. So we get this passed, and we can only have the assistance animals, the dogs or the miniature horses, in the stores, but you still have the customers who have the therapy animals and put them in the cart. And we haven't gotten any backup from the Department of Health in any of the states that we operate in to say, no, they shouldn't be in the carts. And in fact, we've been told, just clean the carts. Well, you have 300 carts in a store. You have thousands of customers through a single store every day. We don't have cart sanitation equipment on site. So it's we can try, but we're not going to catch all the carts that people put their dogs in. So that's a really second important piece to that. So with that, I'll take any questions. Thanks.
I have one. So we could pass this bill, but aren't you still going to have the same problem? You're still going to have these encounters with customers. They're not going to know we've passed the statute. They're still going to try to bring their ferrets and birds into the store. They're still going to regard them as service animals. How is this going to solve the problem for you?
Because we have the legislation to back us up. The manager, the store director can say, actually, the legislature passed a law this year. An assistance animal is only a dog or a miniature horse, and they need to ask you to take your pet back to your car.
Okay. We'll hear from Mr. Gardner, and then we can take more questions.
Co-Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Kenemer, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm here today representing Walmart. I'm passing out the text of the new Washington law, which is the model for the amendment that we are seeking to narrow this bill down to just food establishments, and to impose a species limitation on dogs, and where accommodation can be reasonably made, miniature horses. That's the essence of what it is. That's the essence of what the Washington legislature did, and that's what we would like to urge you to consider. Also included is the staff measure summary for the Washington legislation. It's kind of interesting, as I was preparing for the testimony today, I had an opportunity to read the U.S. Department of Justice recent summary of its ADA rules and the changes that were effective March 15, 2011. And this sort of, I just want to read with your permission this provision, because it kind of highlights the problem. When the department originally issued its Title III regulation, that's under federal ADA, in the early 1990s, the department did not define the parameters of acceptable animal species. And I might add that that's the case with Oregon law right now. There's no species definition or limitation under Oregon law. At that time, few anticipated the variety of animals that would be promoted as service animals in the years to come, which ranged from pigs and miniature horses to snakes, iguanas, and parrots. The department has followed this particular issue closely, keeping current with the many unusual species of animals represented to be service animals. Thus, the department has decided to refine further this aspect of the service animal definition in the final rule, and that's what we would ask you to do along the lines of the amendment that you'll be looking at. From our perspective, and I would totally concur with the preceding comments from Fred Meyer that, you know, we try to accommodate in any way, shape, or form the many varieties of individuals who frequent and patronize our stores, but we also have to be cognizant of the legitimate concerns, sensibilities, and health concerns, frankly, of customers who are in the stores and may be exposed against their will to a public health hazard that is is something that we can do about, something we can do something about if we get this legislation passed.
Questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Bob Junedef and Sybil Head, please.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, Co-Chair Kinnamer. I'm here today with Mr. Junedef from Disability Rights Oregon. We are submitting joint testimony in writing and just wanted to come up and express some of our concerns. From the Law Center's perspective, as you know, we're a nonprofit law firm. Our mission is to ensure that low-income people have access to justice. The existence and the protection of the Fair Housing Act and of the ADA are of critical importance to our clients. They struggle. One of their biggest needs right now, as you know, doubt are familiar, is to achieve and maintain and secure fair, affordable housing. So the protections of these acts are incredibly important to our clients, and so we are concerned about proposed changes. We appreciate the proponent's testimony earlier about narrowing the scope of their proposal, and that's something that I'd be interested to consider and look more fully at the Washington law, and happy to participate in that discussion. I guess I would just flag that these are confusing definitions for everybody. The federal definitions are different from the state definitions. I think from our perspective, we work mostly in the housing context as opposed to the public accommodations context. We're aware that both landlords and tenant organizations really struggle to figure out what the difference is and how to educate their members and individuals about what their rights are and what their obligations are. And so I want to be really careful that any changes that move forward, even if they're narrowed only to apply to restaurants or food establishments, don't use terms that would be commonly misunderstood or commonly thought to apply in other contexts, so that any changes are really narrowly targeted. And frankly, I think in talking to some of my staff across the state, we've sort of felt like there's so many interweaving parts here in Chapter 659 and Chapter 346 and Chapter 90 that have to do with both housing as well as public accommodations, that some time to really sit down and look at this stuff with the folks who can kind of are educated and interested in all of those aspects might be the best way in order to make any change. And so I would just advocate caution, especially on behalf of our clients. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Are you familiar with the Washington law?
And in fact, Representative Kenner, Co-Chair Kenner, Chair Garrett, I had not understood anything about the Washington law until this just this afternoon, so I'll be sure to look at that and get some feedback from our experts about that as well.
Mr. Junedef.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, my name is Bob Junedef. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I want to thank Representative Thompson for bringing this issue forward. But we do have some concerns, and I want to share them with you. First, I'd like to tell you that I did have an LC on this very same topic in the last session. And as I tried to work through the intricacies of the Oregon law and try to match them with the federal structure, I found it to be frustrating and difficult. And it just happens to be the way that the Oregon law is drawn, and the definitions are very inconsistent. And there's some surprising features of the Oregon law. That having been said, in the disability area, we oftentimes come, our office receives a lot of complaints about people who aren't successful in entering businesses or in housing with their assistance animals. So we get to see it from the other direction. And oftentimes, there's a lot of good jokes as we all laughed about some of the situations that have occurred that have been relayed to you, but the reason that we have these provisions in the Americans with Disabilities Act is because there are certain individuals who cannot participate in society. They cannot maintain in their own housing. They cannot go and buy their own food. They cannot go to entertainment without the assistance of a particular animal. And that in those instances, the animal is legally and from a practical point of view viewed not as a pet, but as a piece of assistive technology, that assistance that allows them to function in society. that's easy to understand for a guide dog for the blind, for example, but it's more difficult to understand for a person with significant psychiatric, psychological problems who has trouble walking out of the door without some sort of assistance animal, some sort of comfort. So, drawing the lines between that person and the person who just wants to have Fifi with them in their bag is a hard line to draw, and we acknowledge that. In the federal regulations that have been cited, they were the result of multiple years of getting stakeholders together on the federal level for numerous meetings that resulted in the federal regulations. What we have here is a bill that I saw a few days ago and was not asked to participate in a process, not that I'm anything special, but I know that nobody in the disability community that I'm aware of was brought into a room to try to work on what should the Oregon statutory structure look like. I'd suggest to you that even with these amendments, we have a pretty funky statutory structure that really could use to be cleaned up, even if we were to go down the road of limiting it to dogs and horses. So I think that really bears some attention, and I think that out of respect to the disability community, certainly people who really do depend upon these animals in order to function in society should at least be consulted. And frankly, that just hasn't happened that I am aware of. So I think that I'm very heartened by the offer to take housing out of this, because as we talked about, the Federal Fair Housing Act has a much broader standard, and it would be wouldn't be a good idea to have state law be more narrow than the federal standard, because you're just asking for problems in enforcement. And I also think that the suggestion to limit it like the Washington law is a good idea. If we really do have problems, let's talk about them. And I certainly, for one, in our organization, would be open to reasonable solutions to the practical problems involved. But let me just say one last thing, and then I'll stop, is that issues have been brought up about animals pooping on the floor, animals getting into produce, those sorts of things. Well, as someone who practices in this area, I can tell you that that's not permittable under the federal law for a dog or a horse or any other animal. Assistance animals have to comport themselves in the same way that a customer would. So if a customer isn't allowed to lick the fruit, an animal isn't allowed to lick the fruit. If a customer isn't allowed to poop on the floor, the assistance animal isn't allowed to poop the floor. That doesn't mean, of course, that there aren't other customers who might say, well, how come this person gets to bring their dog in or get to bring an animal in? But I think it's very important to understand that this isn't a wide open invitation to inappropriate behavior in public places. Animals are supposed to behave the same way a patron would. So we just have some concerns that since there are always instances where people abuse these laws by bringing in cobras or whatever, that is not what the law is designed for, and that isn't what most people rely upon it for, and that's not why we have a law that allows for folks to use these accommodations. So thank you very much for this opportunity to bring an alternate perspective.
Thank you. Co-chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your comments. You know, it's an intriguing thing to me, and Chair Garrett and I haven't had the opportunity to discuss some of this kind of stuff either. In a more typical session, I would be very interested in convening a work group. And in 29 days, I'm thinking that's probably not very realistic. I don't know whether we would. I mean, I think it's good for parties to get together and talk, but our time schedule is getting mighty brief, so I'm not optimistic. I do see the need for this, and I think it would be helpful to clarify in some of this, particularly when we get to mental illnesses. I can only imagine how difficult that would be and how you would ever certify that or something is. But I guess I would say to some of the advocates here, there's nothing wrong with asking people to talk. And I think you've done that. Thank you.
Representative Matthews.
My thoughts, and you know, as before, we all had a few little laughs and all had a few jokes. We've all seen the abuse of the situation, and yet I'm sympathetic to the needs of the disabled. But you know, in this bill, we talk about therapy animals as well. And therapy dogs, if I'm not mistaken, they're not certified. They're just simply registered. Is that correct?
Yeah. Representative Matthews, there is no registration for assistance animals of any kind.
Which becomes very problematic, I think. And back to what we heard from Fred Myers in the testimony was, as you said, this does nothing about that contact of, let's go ask a person, is that an assistance animal? And I think that's where the problem lies, is that just about anybody can say that any animal is their assistance animal. And I'm sympathetic to, that's where the abuse occurs, and that's where it's allowed to occur. And, you know, to be quite honest, I think, you know, that they have, we have a responsibility, too, to protect the health and public safety of all, to include in those grocery stores and place of consumption. So I don't know. I guess 29 days isn't a lot of time. But this also seemed like it was going to be fairly simple from jump ball. So here we are. Should have got a dog involved.
Have you got a dog in this fight?
I got an English. You know, Mr. Chair, I have an English bulldog named Zoe, and unfortunately, under current Oregon statute, she could be a therapy dog, and I can take her just about anywhere.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, let me just say that. I don't think that, I don't know if we have a dog lobby here, but we certainly do have people representing folks with disabilities, and they do like to be consulted.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they should be. Mm-hmm. Let's be absolutely clear about that as well. Thank you.
Thank you both. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
We have one more person to testify on this bill. It's Marsha Bullmiller from Boley. Same person.
Oh, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairs Garrett and Kenmer and the rest of the committee. I'm Marsha Olemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I happen to have had a pretty close association with both the federal ADA and the state disability law. I actually worked in Congress when the federal ADA was passed, and I was one of the staff people who worked directly on it. So when I returned to Oregon a few years later and went to work in the public policy area, short time after that, the Oregon legislature decided to amend the Oregon disability law so that it paralleled the federal ADA in most respects. And that was a conscious decision by the legislature to make enforcement and compliance simpler for everyone. As often happens when the legislature decides to make an Oregon law consistent with federal law, especially in the civil rights area, they choose to retain any rights in Oregon law that are more protective of individual rights than what might be in the incoming federal law. So that did happen with the ADA. So there are several provisions in Oregon law of the ADA or of the Oregon law that were there previous to its being made consistent with the federal ADA. One of them was the fact that, so the ADA has several different titles, as most of you probably know. Employment is one, public accommodations is one. And so in public accommodations, they made the Oregon law parallel, but at that time there were no federal definitions of assistance animal for public accommodations. So Oregon's law, this is another thing I want to make you aware of. A lot of the civil rights law on disabilities in Chapter 659A, that's what Boley enforces. That's what was consciously amended to make it parallel to the ADA. The provisions in Chapter 346 were pre-existing to the ADA. They were, and I'm not an expert on this by any means, but from reading them, this is my perception, that they were laid out at a time when there were no disability rights in statute. So they're very specific to people with vision impairments, people with hearing impairments. They're very specific to dogs. But they also didn't, the way 346 is written, they didn't narrow it down to exclude anything but dogs. They just talk specifically about dogs, but it doesn't limit the animals. So when the Oregon law was made parallel in other respects in Chapter 659A, these things were left intact. So the current situation is that Oregon public accommodations law does not have any limits on the type of animals that might be assistance animals. So when we're looking as Boley to enforce the statute, that is how we interpret it. And it is true that a couple of years ago,
different parts of the ADA are enforced by different federal agencies. The U.S. Department of Justice is responsible for the public accommodations piece, so it was their regulations. And as Mr. Junduff pointed out, very long considered and thoughtful process that they went through to decide to narrow down the definition of assistance animals at the federal level for public accommodations. So that's the process they went through. Oregon law still has remained with no limits on what can be an assistance animal. So that's just some statutory background that I hope is helpful. I'm just going to speak to the bill as I saw it, not as people have discussed how they might want to narrow it down, because that's what I came prepared to talk about. But so that would be one implication of the bill as written, is that it would very drastically and suddenly limit assistance animals under public accommodations law in Oregon to dogs. And I honestly don't know the history of how miniature horses were so favored to be included, but there you have it. I mean, I can't speak to, you know, I'm sure their process had something to do with how they picked miniature horses, but and I'm not saying casting any aspersions on that, but I think there's some serendipity there maybe. The other piece of what the bill would do is, and I understand this was maybe inadvertent from hearing the testimony of the proponents today, because the way it's written, it would apply that narrow definition of assistance animals to housing law as well. And again, it doesn't amend Chapter 659A, it amends a piece of Chapter 346 that by reference is attached to Chapter 659A and relates to housing accommodation for people with disabilities. And so it would connect that newly narrowed definition of assistance animals also to Oregon housing disability law, which we also enforce. And from Bowley's perspective, that's especially problematic because, and some of you who have been here the last few years might remember this, Bowley and this legislature probably took, I don't know, we think 5 or 6 sessions to try to make Oregon housing disability or housing discrimination law substantially equivalent to federal law, for the reason that federal HUD wanted to contract with the state of Oregon for co-enforcement through Bowley. And so that was an extremely long and tedious process, and substantial equivalency really requires that the state law and the federal law be in lockstep in every respect. So huge amendments to Oregon law took place to match the federal housing and the state housing law. And again, a piece of that is the definition of assistance animal from federal law, which would bring it, you know, changing that would change the substantial equivalency piece of that relationship. So this is a complicated area. Yeah. It's got a complicated statutory history. It's unfortunate that at the time the legislature took a lot of time and thought to make the statutes equivalent, they didn't look at the pieces in Chapter 346, and I don't know why that was. It just didn't happen, to try to make there be some either, you know, thoughtfully blend them together or maybe repeal some and that sort of thing. And I can't say, you know, we don't enforce 346 provisions. They might be being used in private rights of action, and I'm not aware of that. But so another side effect of the bill would be that it has some definitions in it that definition of public accommodations is really different from what it is in Chapter 659A. It's actually broader. Apparently that's not what they intended, but that's what it would be. The definition of disability is not the same 659A. And it doesn't use the word disability, it uses the word impairment, but it's sort of the same, but not quite really. So that's very confusing in terms of trying to decide, like, what population are you covering? Are these people with disabilities the same as those in Chapter 659A or not? So just a few things that I wanted to make you aware of, and I hope that information was helpful, but I have to say, as the enforcement agency who's primarily involved in this, it would be very discombobulating for us if it suddenly changed, because we'd have some equivalency problems with federal law and just having to align ourselves with something that was not done by a process. And I think, as Mr. Junduff said, what would be most helpful is for folks with disabilities to be here speaking to this issue, because I don't know, from the assistance animal perspective, I don't know what the needs are. So,
all right. Thank you for that explanation. Any questions for Ms. Oldmiller? All right, thanks a lot for being here. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
We'll close the hearing. I'll just say for the record, I agree with what Co-Chair Kenemer had to say on this. We thought it an issue worthy of hearing. I think there's a legitimate issue presented here, but it's also clear that some conversations that haven't happened yet and need to happen for this bill to have a chance to move. So I hope that will happen over the next
weekend.
Either over the next weekend or maybe over the next 10 months. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill, 4053. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4092. Will staff please give an overview of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4092 expands the entities that can apply for a special events distillery license to both distillery licensees and a bona fide trade association that represents distilleries. The measure outlines the privileges of the license, conditions for the licensee to follow when they're operating under the license, and items that must be included in the license application. There's an emergency clause in the measure effective upon passage.
Thank you. And we'll start with Representative Harker, and the other those on the panel are Eric Martin and Lee Medoff, please.
Yes, sir. Chair Garrett. Chair Kinnemer, committee members, thank you very much. For the record, I am Chris Harker, the representative from House District 34. Colleagues, we're all well aware of the need to create some employment opportunities in our state and make changes that will help the business community do just that. There's certainly limitations on what we can do from these seats, but House Bill 4092 addresses a very real need of one sector of our economy, the craft distilleries. These businesses are located all over our states in many of our districts. They are growing and hopefully can develop into employers and revenue generators along the lines of what the craft breweries and wineries have become. This bill is an opportunity for us to help them and at no cost to the general fund. Briefly, here's the situation. Like breweries and wineries, distilleries have to be licensed to operate. Like breweries and wineries, distilleries can have tasting rooms and sell their products from those tasting rooms. Like breweries and wineries, distilleries can have tasting events at other sites. However, at those events, breweries and wineries can sell their products, but the distilleries cannot. House Bill 4092 is intended to level the playing field in that regard. It establishes the conditions under which distilled spirits can be sold at special events. It's a simple and a short bill for our short session, and I thank you for hearing it. We have the gentleman here from the craft distillery world, and I will close just by saying that, yes, I did become aware of this issue around a campfire sipping a craft whiskey.
Was it good?
Aye, that it was.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairman, Vice Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Eric Martin, and I am the president of the Oregon Distillers Guild. We are a trade association that represents over 30 craft distilleries throughout the state of Oregon. First, I'd like to thank Representative Harker for introducing House Bill 4092, and I'd like to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon in support of this bill. The Oregon Distillers Guild supports this bill because it opens up many new marketing and sales opportunities for Oregon's craft distillation industry, and it helps us expand our businesses and create jobs for Oregonians. If I can echo what Representative Harker has said, the intent of this bill is to help our industry achieve parity with Oregon's wineries and breweries. Currently, however, unlike our brethren in the winery and brewery industry, Oregon distilleries cannot sell their products directly to a consumer at industry trade events. Wineries and breweries, on the other hand, may do so. As the law stands now, potential customers may only have a small sample of our products at these trade events, and they get to listen to our stories as we share our wares. And then after that, we can only hope that the potential customer follows through with a purchase at any one of the agency stores. However, by the time they get to an agency store, most likely they have long since forgotten their encounter with us and go on to purchase their out-of-state liquor brand. This bill would revise the statutes to allow Oregon distilleries to make the sale right then and there when the potential customer is most interested in the product, thus increasing the likelihood of future sales for the business. As far as accounting for the state's portion of the revenue from the sale, with this bill, there will be an accounting mechanism already in place. Currently, Oregon distillers may apply for a retail endorsement to their license, which allows sales at state-designated prices at the distillery only. Then the distillery remits the markup back to the state, just like any agency retail store. This bill extends that endorsement to allow distilleries to sell at qualified special events and remit the state's markup back to the state the same as it would as if the product was sold at the distillery. There are also built-in safety controls. We are seeking a permit to allow sales at qualified special events, which are controlled environments where there would be no sales to minors, as minors would not be allowed on the premises where the event is being held. Or there's also no sales to visibly intoxicated persons or anyone else that would not be otherwise allowed to make a purchase of those products. In sum, this bill ultimately increase revenue and open up new business opportunities for Oregon distilleries and increase revenue for the state, all without raising taxes, while at the same time it gives Oregon's craft distillation movement a leg up in the face of a challenging future for our industry. With that, I ask for your support of this bill, and I thank you for this your time this afternoon. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Should we
wait till they're all done?
Let's wait till they're finished, and then we'll go through. Mr. Medoff?
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Lee Medoff. I'm the past president of the Oregon Distillers Guild back when we had less than half of our members that we do now. And I'm the current distiller and owner of Bull Run Distillery up in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to speak on behalf of this bill also. The craft distilling industry has a lot of challenges in front of it, and one of those is in the marketing of our products. And the industry has been very, very active in creating events, not just through the individual distilleries, but through the guild. And through these events, we're able to bring in a lot of people, not just locals, but we take advantage of the tourism, the culinary tourism that we have in this state. They come to these events, and we're able to show our products to them. Most people that we get in front of love our products. They want to take it back home with them. They want to find it right away. But we're unable at these events, to actually get them a bottle to their hands. And this bill would definitely help us with our marketing efforts to be able to get the product into the consumer's hands for either, especially take it outside the state and showing people around what we have here, these great products we have here in Oregon. But I'm just here to show support for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Doherty.
Okay. My question is just, what is the definition of a qualified market event?
It's an event.
Just give me an example.
Okay. It would be similar to the Spring Beer and Wine Fest that is held every spring at the Oregon Convention Center. That is an event where the hosting party applies to the commission for approval to hold the event via the permitting process. This makes the commission aware of the event so that they can monitor the event for compliance.
Okay. Follow-up question? I've never been to those. I'm not much of a drinker. I know in tasting rooms you can buy the wine, you can buy the beer. With these special events, do they sell bottles of wine and beer right now?
They do sell bottles of wine and bottles of beer.
So you guys are asking for the same privilege?
Yes, yes.
So instead of like beer fest, it would be whiskey fest or something like that.
Yes.
Okay.
Further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there or are there precedents for this in other states? Other states have policies that are more.
There is a similar bill being worked up in the state of Washington that I'm aware of. However, I think in California, can they do that?
No, they cannot.
Okay. I'm not sure about other states because I have not provided a case study on their laws, but I do know that there are similar bills. There is a similar bill being worked up in the state of Washington.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Co-Chair Kenemer.
I think I heard there are around, what, 43 distillers? Two or three, of course, are gigantic, and then craft distillers. Do you have a number on that?
Yes, there are 43 federally licensed distilleries in the state of Oregon. That number is correct. And the two largest would be Hood River Distillery and I think it's Bend Distillery in Bend, Oregon.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No one else has signed up to testify, but I know somebody from the OLTC is here, and we'd love to hear from you if you have comments on the bill in general. Anything we should know?
Good afternoon, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, my name is Farshad Aladadi. I'm the Director of Licensed Services at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The agency is neutral on this bill, but I will say that we have had a number of conversations with the Oregon Distillers Guild and have given them some technical suggestions to this proposal that I think accomplishes their goals, their aims, but makes it a little bit more simple to administer. And hopefully those suggestions may end up as amendments, but as for now, that's been our interaction with them.
So as of now, your recommendations are not in the bill?
Correct, as introduced, they're not. We've had conversations as late as yesterday afternoon that would streamline some of the administrative pieces of it.
Okay. Chair Kenemer?
Yeah, I guess I'd like to know, can you give us some examples of that? And also I'd like to discuss the issue of the difference between allowing this versus our current restriction, which is either at the distillery or in our authorized stores.
Sure. Chair Garrett, Co-Chair Kinnemer, some of the suggestions that we're making, one of the problems that we're seeing is that there is a difference between the ability to sell bottles from an Oregon base distillery, a distillery licensed in Oregon, and distilleries that are based outside of the state. When we have a, as you know, there
as in an event where they, I'm sorry, I missed your point.
Oh, sure. Well, these manufacturers exist both inside and outside of Oregon, and the businesses that are located inside Oregon are able to sell their product by the bottle from the they've set up a contract with the commission so that the markup is realized by the commission when that bottle sale happens. However, the distilleries that are outside of the state don't have such an agreement. Their products are shipped into the state through our warehouse and sold through liquor stores. And so if these out-of-state distilleries were to participate in one of these events and choose to sell by the bottle, there would be some difficulty in collecting that markup for those products. So we've had discussions about mechanisms to collect that revenue and how we might do that, and those would are addressed in the amendment, in a possible future amendment, hopefully.
Representative.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee members. We do have a -2 amendment prepared, but we did not elect to introduce it at this point because it was on such short time frame. We will gladly submit that to you if you so desire.
And would you like to discuss the -1 that's also?
Yes, the -1 amendment, which I believe you do have, addresses some inaccuracy in language that was simply a misconstruence in terms of the language spoken to LC and what came back from LC, all of which was around limitations on the amount of product which could
so
be sold.
We have a -1 that would eliminate those limitations from the bill.
Correct.
And there's a -2 that's in progress?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Which would be a consensus amendment?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Agreed.
Yes. And you said in process, do you have a timeline?
We can have
that
to you.
We're on a pretty tight crunch here.
Yes, we could have that to you, the committee, later today or Monday morning at the very earliest.
Oh, okay. So it's coming promptly, is I guess
yes,
my concern.
Yes, Chair Kinnemer.
And you think this addresses the issues that have been brought up by OLCC?
I am told by OLCC and the Oregon Distillers Guild that these this amendment does address those concerns in a manner acceptable
to both parties. At least conceptually, we'll see how it reads.
Yes,
is that,
correct.
Are we both nodding heads on this?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Thank you. That's what I thank you.
Were there more questions over here? All right. Thanks, both of you. Appreciate your time. We'll look for the amendment and close the public hearing on House Bill 4092. Move to our final bill of the day, which is open a public hearing on House Bill 4094. And Representative Swan.
Chair, with due regard for the time, shall I just introduce the bill from up here?
Whatever is your preference.
Bring the first panel up and sure. I'll introduce the bill to the committee. So we all know, I think, that the construction industry has suffered particularly badly in the recession, and I've heard some stunning numbers like 40% unemployment in the industry, and we know that that impacts businesses as well as workers, and it has real measurable human impacts in our communities. Over the last year, I guess, I've been approached a number of times by constituents in the construction industry to talk about issues that they face, both economic and regulatory. And on the economic side, I think our powers are limited. We'd all like to do what we can, but on the regulatory side, I was convinced that there were some opportunities to do some good for these folks. And in particular, a number of contractors approached me about some costs that they were incurring that were probably not providing corollary benefits to the state. And in particular, I was struck by one gentleman who was in his 60s, and you know, we all know contractors. I have family members in the construction industry. I've been in the construction industry, and he looked like a typical contractor and had a rough, firm handshake. And as he started describing what had happened to his business over the last couple of years and what was happening to him personally, you know, his voice became hoarse and he began to tear up. And so naturally, as we all would, I took what he said to heart and became convicted about trying to look for opportunities to help relieve some of the regulatory burden on his business. So what I found out of the list of complaints that were brought to me by constituents was a licensure requirement, and decided that would be a good opportunity to start. It's not a cure-all, but it could have an effect. Turns out that this licensure requirement, if an applicant for an exempt contractor's license goes in, they have to show, among other things, that they have a workers' compensation policy, and they have to commit to keep that workers' compensation policy in place. An exempt contractor is one without any workers. So I thought that was somewhat ironic and probably something that was easily addressed. Lo and behold, I was shocked to find that it's not as easy as it might seem on the surface, and there's a lot of history behind this issue and a lot of reasons it isn't as straightforward as I had hoped. However, the bill that you have before you, that I hope we will work in short order, is one that I think addresses it fairly, takes care of some of the issues that were raised. The last thing I'll do is describe briefly the process that we went through. We had a number of meetings where we invited hopefully all of the stakeholders in this issue and tried to really work through the concerns and understand the potential consequences of changing this rule. I don't think we reached consensus. However, we did our best, and that was so a significant amount of time and energy was expended by a lot of people who came and had input into the process. And with that, I will allow last thing that I wanted to mention, mention, is that I don't know if anybody from Workers' Comp, John Schultz is here, is scheduled to testify, but we do have folks.
He's on the list.
Oh, he is on the list. Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
Okay.
So that's it.
All right. Well, why don't we start with two witnesses here to testify for the bill, Gordon Fittis and John Rakowitz, please.
Co-Chair Garrett and Co-Chair Kenemer, members of the committee,
I'd like to thank Representative Conger for submitting this bill, and thank you for giving the bill a hearing. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 4094.
Did he introduce himself? I need to, for the record, your name, please.
Oh, my name's Gordon Fittis. And I've been in business for 29 years as a contractor in the state of Oregon. House Bill 4094 is a simple way that Oregon can cut one piece of unnecessary red tape and expense for small businesses. And it will save small businesses thousands of dollars. Under the current law, the CCB registration requires me to purchase workers' comp, and I am a business owner, and I don't have employees. And what I found is that I have a different standard that I have to meet to for workers' comp. They have different standards for business owners. And my insurance, my health insurance, recognizes that, and they cover any injuries that I have on the job because I am a business owner. And so by requiring me to purchase workers' comp, I'm having to pay double for the same coverage. That's what it amounts to. Workers' comp costs my business, if I got it, it would be between $2,000 or $3,000, depending on how records are kept. That's the quote that was given to me by SAFE. And Bill 4094 provides an option for a business owner to purchase appropriate insurance for a business owner. And as it stands now, my company is not registered as a general contractor. It is simply a residential contractor as a result of this requirement. Thank you. Any questions?
We'll hear from John Rakowitz first, and then we'll take questions if there are any.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, co-chairs, members of the committee. John Rakowitz, for the record, with AGC, Associated General Contractors. Many of you probably know that AGC was one of the architects of the original, and I want to point out we're only talking about the commercial contracting licensure law. We're not talking about a requirement here for workers' comp. It does not apply to small commercial and does not apply to residential. So it's strictly the part of the industry that I represent. We were a part of that 2007 law. We believe it provides not only consumer protections, it provides benefits to contractors and the industry at large, and it does so by raising the standards of practices. That's true for all the general requirements for large commercial. It's definitely true for the requirement that the bill is about, which is the requirement for contractors to carry workers' comp for large commercial endorsement. It's critical to our industry for a couple of reasons, this particular requirement. And it helps maintain a level playing field, and it guards against the shifting of cost. And the scenario that was relatively prevalent that drove this was you'd have a crew show up, 10, 15 people, they all declared themselves an independent contractor, and guess what? They did not have to carry workers' comp like everybody else on the job, and that did two things. One, it makes it an uncompetitive, non-competitive playing field for those who do carry it. And secondly, if somebody gets hurt, it shifts the cost burden. To whom? Well, to other contractors on the job, the general contractor, and or the system at large. So we consider, and I'm underscoring this, because we consider it a key component to keep in place. Now, having said that, with that in mind, we support this bill. And we do because the exemption being proposed, we believe, addresses a real issue, and that for the typical kind of contractor, like Gordon sitting here next to me, that owns and operates with no employees, that's narrowly drawn in that fashion because we believe in that workers' comp requirement. The bottom line for us, and I've been at work on this bill with various people for probably about a year now, is that this will provide real relief and eliminate, in our view, an unnecessary cost for some of the hardest hit contractors in the state of Oregon. Our industry was 5% of the state's economy when this downturn started. Today, we represent 2.5%. So the unemployment rate, I mean, the contractors are going out of business all over the place. You got every trade in the world benched, some of them at 20, 30, 40% unemployment in a particular trade, depending on what hole they're working out of. So this is real. We believe it's real relief, but it does not undermine the workers' comp system and the need to keep that level playing field, but again, only for large commercials. So with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions.
Okay, I have a question, John, and maybe it's more of a definition. As you said that you don't have to have workers' comp if it's residential, and did you say small commercial?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What is the definition of small commercial?
Okay, I'm going to try to recall. There are people in the room who probably have it on the top of their head. I believe it's 12,000 square foot and a certain height. I don't remember the height. And basically, think about a 7-Eleven rehab. Think about small commercial.
Oh, okay.
So you're allowed to do that without any of the requirements associated with licensure, including workers' comp and all residential, and it was written into the original law to try to take into account that really doesn't demand the kind of bonding or workers' comp type protections that we put in place as a part of that law.
Okay.
So that's sort of the rationale, and to allow... And we're not in the business at AGC of putting contractors out of business. So, but we do think large commercial, when we're talking bridges and big buildings downtown here or anything else, public or private, there is a level of complexity and a level of consumer protection and a standard of practice that was embodied in this law. And that's why we're big defenders and remain so.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that somebody like a Gordon, an owner-operator, should be put in a position to have to... carry an unnecessary cost, particularly in this economy.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
Good explanation.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. One is there is a definite difference between personal health insurance, and I see you have personal disability insurance.
Mm-hmm.
What about your wages?
Is the question...
That's a question. What happened to those? Well, we're going to not have any wages? Whereas if you had workman's comp, you would have a wage, would you not? Income?
Co-chairs, Representative Esquivel, I'm not real sure how this doesn't apply to any of the prevailing wage laws or...
No.
Yeah.
I'm talking about if you get hurt on the job, you get a certain amount of your wage back to you. I'm not saying that that's happening with this.
Understood. Co-chairs, Representative Esquivel, I think you're going to hear some of that testimony for those who may not be in agreement with this law. I will tell you what we've been looking for from a contractor's point of view is maintain a fair playing field, maintain workers' comp where we believe it's absolutely critical. The exemption you're talking about, we've worked this thing about three different ways, and it does not deal with the issue of wages while you're injured, which is what you're getting at.
Right.
It's correct.
Follow up. How many partners can I have?
Oh, I'm sorry.
If I could address that a little further. If I, as a business owner who has no employees, am working by myself somewhere, which is often the case when I'm working in buildings, and I get injured, workers' comp is not going to cover me anyway. And so I will not have that kind of coverage, unless it's verifiable that the accident happened there, and it's just a standard procedure that if you don't have a witness, then you don't have a case.
So if I could,
is that in the law that you have to have a witness?
It's not true. Okay. I disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. I've managed plants where people have been by themselves, where they have worked under workman's comp by themselves, hurt themselves, nobody witnessed it, and we paid workman's comp.
And they were business owners?
No. They're workers.
Exactly. I'm a business owner, and I'm held to a different standard than employees are.
Why don't we bring up Mr. Schultz from workers' comp, and he can help us understand this.
Well, I'm not finished yet.
You can keep going.
Yeah, I wanted to know about the partners. No one answered the partners.
You can.
How many partners can I have?
You're working alone.
Co-chairs.
Oh, it says partners.
Yes.
Plural.
That's co-chairs, Representative Esquivel. That has to do with the definition of definition of exempt independent contractors. And the reason to include them is to take into account the concern that if Gordon is out on a job and his wife or his son, and remember, we're only talking about that class, and it's defined as that, then they must also, and you'll see in the bill, have this coverage as well. So we're trying to be inclusive of anybody who is on the job, who is a part of an owner-operator and business classified as an exempt independent contractor.
Okay, now
it's very technical, and that's why we struggled
for
so long.
How many partners can I have?
That's the original question.
Is it
unlimited?
Co-chairs, Representative Esquivel, no, I do not believe it is, but I suspect that there's an individual in the room that might be able to answer that question. I'm looking at Craig Smith from CCB. I believe it's two or three. Each of these classes are defined in another part of the law.
Mm-hmm.
What we were trying to get at is the broad classification, not change the law. The broad classification, if you are an exempt independent contractor, which means by definition you have no employees, you are an owner and you are an operator, that that's the only, the exemption would apply to that class of contractors, if that helps at all.
Mr. Schultz, can you shed light on any of what has transpired here?
I think I can, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appreciate the invitation to be here today. I'll try to hit the issues as I jotted them down, and if I miss something, please just ask. In regard to the income that Representative Esquivel brought up, that would be part of what the disability insurance would be there for. It's primarily income replacement insurance, and in fact some insurers just call it that directly. It is different than workers' compensation income replacement, but that's what that insurance coverage was supposed to be about. In regard to the maximum number of partners, under the workers' compensation law today, the maximum number of exempt partners is two partners. So once you exceeded two partners, you'd need to buy workers' compensation coverage under workers' compensation law today. The only exception to that is if each partner has 10 employees, then it's one. Then I believe there's an exemption on one partner for each 10 ownership employees. And I'm trying to check my notes to see if I think I left that out. But to directly answer your question, it's up to two partners would remain exempt. Then there was another question. Just another issue that I would comment on in regard to the sole proprietor performing labor without assistance from others. The issue that Mr. Fittis was referring to in regard to the standard of proof on a claim, the workers' compensation law today says no claim shall be allowed or paid except upon corroborative evidence in addition to the evidence of the claimant. So that would be the sole proprietor, mm-hmm. independent contractor. Examples of corroboration that I just pulled out quickly in preparation for today was same as what Mr. Fittis noted. The injury is witnessed. That would be great corroboration. Or I've seen many times where the physician that treats the injured sole proprietor finds that the injury is consistent with the description of the accident or the mechanics of the accident, and that is corroboration. So that is an additional standard for a person who is elected workers and paid for workers' compensation coverage who acts as a sole proprietor today. But the standard it's not altogether that different from any injured worker. It's a fairly high standard in Oregon to meet. The burden of proof is on the worker to demonstrate that they were injured at work. I guess the last thing I would say is that independent contractors, sole proprietors, partnerships, LLCs, what have you, can elect to buy workers' compensation coverage today. It is available in Oregon. Mm-hmm. The annual premiums vary depending on the type of business organization that I just mentioned. If you're a sole proprietor, it's going to be less expensive. LLC, S-type corporations, more expensive. And that varies from about $2,000 to $12,000 annually. And it also depends on which insurer you get it through. It's going to be most expensive if you have to go through the assigned risk or the high-risk market. That's the most expensive type of insurance. But that is sure insurance. You can get the insurance here in Oregon. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. I appreciate you coming forward to clarify some of those things. Representative Johnson, was there a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There may be just more comments and questions, but I think I just wanted to go back to, I think, Representative Conger's opening comments about what I think would be the intent behind the bill or the legislation, in that it is a very narrowly constructed, narrowly tailored piece of legislation that addresses a very narrow segment of the job market where there are some needs for some flexibility. I would fit into that category the same as Mr. Fettes does. I'm a sole proprietor. I work primarily by myself in the residential mm-hmm. world, if you will. If I get a call to go do a very specialized project in the commercial world, mm-hmm. I can't do that legally. I would have to, just as Mr. Fettes, to apply for, obtain the workers' comp in order for me to do that. I guess I would just hope we could keep in mind the scope and scale of what we're talking about here. We're not talking about building a 12,000-foot building. We're talking about probably working within a 12,000-foot building, performing a very specialized task. And I think he's into refurbishing whatever your job, you know, little niche is. I mean, we're talking cabinets, we're talking doors, we're talking things like that. Right. And more than likely, that's not where the lion's share of your work is performed. I'm guessing you would float back and forth between residential projects, commercial projects. But again, we're getting back to what trying to help people in a segment of our economy that has had some very difficult times in the last few years, and just trying to enable certain people who have a certain refined skill set be able to perform a very narrowly targeted, requested service. That's what this is all about. We're not trying to upset the whole workers' comp world here. We're just trying to make it easier for a very specialized type of contractor to do what they are qualified to do without having to incur additional costs or to change their whole business model. In a nutshell, that's what it's all about. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, thanks to the three of you for being here.
Thanks.
We now have Greg Miller and Brian Krieg, please.
Co-Chairs Garrett and Co-Chair Kennerber. My name is Greg Miller. I'm here today representing the Oregon Building Trades, National Electrical Contractors Association, and the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors. Here primarily to give you a little bit more historical context as to the bill that was passed in 2007 that changed the CCB licensing structure in Oregon and why that came about. As some of you recall, in 2005 and 2006, residential construction defect became a very, very big issue that the legislature attempted to deal with. In doing that, they established what was called the Construction Claims Task Force that met in 2006. They addressed just about every issue you can think of under the sun that had to do with commercial construction, means and methods, bonding requirements, insurance requirements, the whole gamut of the construction industry. AGC saw this as an opportunity to self-police their industry, especially as the commercial construction industry. We felt it necessary to try to separate ourselves a little bit from the residential market, and that's where you have today the four different licensing endorsements that you have at the Construction Contractors Board with the residential, small commercial, and large commercial construction contractors.
You said four, but you just listed three.
A small commercial, I believe, is one as well. Small and large mm-hmm. residential, small and large commercial construction. And again, as Mr. Rakowitz said, part of the effort was an attempt to end the gaming of independent contractors who would come in as a group of independent contractors, really under the direction and control of one main person who was operating the job. So in an effort to bring the entire industry on board, that was part of the negotiation in getting the bill passed in 2007. In crafting the legislation passed in 2007, AGC was acutely aware of the fact that we did not want to limit anybody's ability to grow as a contractor in Oregon. Prior to these licensing laws, and I don't want to oversimplify, but a gentleman with a pickup saw and a hammer could go to the CCB, take a test, and become a general contractor. Therefore, we saw it necessary to establish some steps that folks could take to build themselves up, learn the industry, start to develop themselves as reputable construction contractors, and grow into what would be considered a large commercial contractor. I think that as a result of the 2007 law, the industry is safer. The workers' comp requirements that we're talking about today, as been mentioned, are exempt in three classes. The class that is not exempt is your large commercial construction. We feel that as a large commercial contractor, you've grown into the ability and the necessity to carry the same type of coverages that other large commercial contractors need to carry. This doesn't keep people from remodeling the 7-Elevens, the small commercial contract projects that we talked about, but when you get into the large OHSU hospital scenarios, when there's you're not the only person installing cabinets, you've got plumbers, you've got sheetrock guys, you've got electricians, everybody working around you. You're not working in a vacuum. Therefore, your ability, your incurrence of risk grows, and with that, workers' comp covers you in case of an injury. So, I'll finish by saying, there have been some growing pains. I think that it's taken some time for people to get used to some of the new requirements. Continuing education is a new requirement, but people are starting to get familiar with that requirement. They're fulfilling that with the CCB as they renew their licenses, and the construction industry in Oregon, I believe, is better because of the laws passed in 2007.
Thanks a lot. Mr. Krieg, you want to go ahead?
Excuse me. Sorry.
Sure.
Should pass. So you're in support of this or in opposition?
Yeah, we oppose the bill.
Thank you for the question.
I'm sorry, but it wasn't. Maybe I didn't listen clearly.
No, you didn't say it. Mr. Krieg.
Chair Garrett, Chair Kinnemer, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. Today here I'm representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, Sheet Metal Workers Local 16, and IBEW. Mr. Miller gave a very good overview, I think, of some of the process we went back through with the Construction Task Force in redesigning the licensing in the state and the standards that would be needed there. There were quite a few problems in differing areas. The gaming of the system by folks who were coming in saying they were independent contractors was getting to be a substantive problem for legitimate contractors getting underbid by folks who weren't having to pay all of the fees and weren't necessarily taking care of the employees, the employee possibly being the individual. There's impacts to the state about that. If you have somebody who isn't covered with insurance properly and they're working in construction and they get injured, the long-term situation can be is that they're going to end up with cost factors that get pushed back into the healthcare system that we all pay for. The the suggestion here, we are opposed to the measure. I'll get that back out in front, in that we examined a lot of ideas during that construction task force meetings. Those meetings, there were quite a few of them, many, many hours, and trying to do a mousetrap to figure out a way to make it work where people were doing things legitimately was difficult. And the use of workers' comp was the one area that we could all, everyone in the room, and all kinds of associations were involved there, with big, small, independent, union, non-union, everyone in the room. And this was the one area where we could focus in and say, this would take care of people. It also put up a bit of a barrier then to people trying to just come in and game the system. I think the issue of trying to find some relief out there, we're not unsympathetic to situations that are out there, but the approach being taken with this, going in and substituting health insurance, I don't think is the right approach on here. One of the things is what really constitutes health insurance? We can have it through Blue Cross, and it could be a very Cadillac program. It could also be something that's pulled down off of those signs we see on telephone poles out there. Where is the level, and what are they actually going to cover, and will they be there? Will they cover an injury in reality? And this is an issue that really isn't explored in here as to how we're going to administer this, how we're going to monitor it, and I think it's going to be very difficult for some of the enforcement factors. We did think that the concept of the penalty that was thrown in using a little different approach was novel and something that may need some further exploration. But at this point in time, we can't support the bill as it is.
Thank you, Mr. Craig. Representative Conger.
I'm sure that the contractors who are struggling to make a living and people like Gordon who are having to give up their commercial license so they're limited in the number of projects that they can even work on, notwithstanding that they have the skill set and no employees, appreciate your concern for their well-being. However, a couple of quick points. One is that, and this came up in a number of contexts, this is not the only one that it did. The large commercial projects implies OHU size projects, but they're not. The limit is lower than that. And so what happens, I think, or what has happened in the industry is that contractors who would typically have both kinds of licenses, so they work on both kinds of projects, but probably not up to the scale of an OHU SU size project, so maybe not big public works and stuff. But they'd be able to work in a commercial building. What has happened is they have been hit by the economy. They may have actually gone from having employees to not having employees, and now they're struggling just to keep their homes. And as a result of the impact on their business, they're looking for any job they can get. And when they reach that point, the added cost, which may not seem like much to you, of a couple thousand dollars, when they're already paying for health insurance, and they probably already have long-term disability, which functionally is the same as, very close to the same as workers' compensation. It's not identical, it's very close. And also protects them outside of the work environment, so they need that as well, if you're really concerned about their well-being. The doubling up of that cost creates an issue where they're confronted with the choice, do I bear that cost and hope that I get a job where I would need that license, or do I give it up? And do I cut myself out of that segment of the market? And I ran into this over and over again. And the reason I want to raise that with you is because the cost of getting the large commercial license is not just the workers' compensation policy. It's also that they have to get a separate bond. They have separate continuing education costs, and they have the separate licensing costs. So the combined effect is that you are cutting people out who are perfectly well qualified. These are good players in the market, and they need the work. That's the problem. This is not an unreal, metaphysical argument here. This is real life stuff. People losing their houses, people who are qualified. And so I appreciate the commentary about the history. I got educated about that very well during the process of working on this bill, and I do understand the reasons behind the separate licensing regime. But I want to sort of step back and just remind everybody, it's workers' compensation It's for workers. The whole system evolved to benefit workers and to protect workers from exploitative employers. We're talking about small contractors here. And if you're saying it's illegitimate for a solo practitioner, for a single person to be a contractor, or that they're not capable of doing these projects that overlap on the lower end of the large commercial scale, I think you're wrong. Feel free to respond.
Comment on that?
Co-chairs Garrett and Kennemer, if I could respond really quickly, I would not characterize this as a small contractor issue as well. There are large, reputable contractors who have been doing business in this state who are either consolidating with other companies or closing their doors, laying off folks as well. So if I characterize this as a big versus small, that's my mistake. This is an industry-wide issue, but the fact remains, large commercial contractors, we feel need to carry workers' comp to protect themselves and protect workers.
Representative Doherty. Okay.
And I appreciate Mr. Fittis's situation and problems, and he's a very, very diligent contractor, a very diligent person that gets these things. But for every Gordon Fittis, there are 10 other people that don't get insurance, and if they can't afford workers' comp, they certainly can't afford health insurance and disability insurance and income replacement insurance. And I think that's the concern. Are not diligent contractors like Mr. Fittis, but the ones that don't carry anything, and they're the ones that end up in the system and costing lots of people lots of money. So you know, that's again part of my concern, is that this is not necessarily workers' comp. I've never viewed as something that, oh boy, we're going to make a lot of money at it. It's the idea of, we want it, if somebody gets hurt, we want to make sure that they have some sort of system to be able to get back to work and so on. But you know, if everybody was like Mr. Fittis, we would have no problems. But unfortunately, I think he's the exception, not the rule. So,
all right, thank you both. I think we need to move to our final two witnesses. I have Jody Getzlow and Pat Maloney.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, appreciate the time for hearing this bill. My name is Pat Maloney. I'm the president of Tice Electric Company based in Portland, Oregon, and I'm also the chairman of the Joint Legislative Committee for the National Electrical Contractors Association. We have members of large size, small size, down to individual proprietors who are in the same situation, and our organization opposes this bill. We appreciate what Representative Conger was talking about, job creation, and what Greg said earlier. That is critical to our industry right now, and with where we're at, you know, work is slow, and anything we can do to create jobs is a good thing, but this isn't one of those things. It won't create more jobs. We appreciate being involved as NECA in the task force that was created, or the work group, to discuss this, that was created by Representative Conger and AGC. One of the first things that was brought before that group, as well as here, is that work comp is a product that a sole proprietor cannot use. That they, you know, what the gentleman said earlier, they do not have any further burden of proof than any of our regular employees. We have employees all throughout our different organizations in NECA that have been injured by themselves many times, and you must have corroborating evidence. And it's an appeal, or it's a claims-driven process, and the doctors are involved, and those doctors have to state that injury occurred on the job site or could have occurred. And that's the same process that an employee for a large company would go through, or a sole proprietor. There's no difference in the level of burden on that. You can't just go in and say, I was injured on the job, if you work for a large employer, and not have, you know, symptoms that would be the same thing that would make sense. Let's see. The other good point that was brought up is workers' compensation isn't just health insurance. You know, in order to create a product, to get the same coverage that we get as or our employees or sole proprietors get from workers' comp, you would need a health insurance plan that covered, and this is a key factor, that did cover workplace injuries. And I'm not aware of many of those products that are out there. You would also need a short-term disability policy to cover your wages in the interim while you got back to health to get back to work. And you would also need a third policy of a long-term disability policy that would pay your wages in the event that you were disabled permanently. I don't see how, you know, allowing people to work without workers' comp is going to make them more cost-effective and make sure that they're still in the same safe boat. Workers' comp is designed to cover people injured who are on the jobs, and if you just say, well, you don't have to have work comp anymore, you're not going to have that full protection, and it just doesn't make sense to me. We believe in the workers' compensation plan. It's a good plan. It works great for everybody. We want a level playing field. That's been brought up many times. Everybody should have to have this. It is a good policy to have these coverages if you're injured, whether you're a sole proprietor or you work for a large company. We appreciate Representative Conger involving us in the process. We just don't really see this as a valid solution to solve the problem he's trying to solve. Our organization thoroughly went through this bill, and at this time, we cannot support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Jody.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, and I'm just thank you for hearing us today. My name is Jody Getzel Parker. I am a laborer by trade and recently appointed to the Columbia Pacific Building Trades as one of their executive secretary treasurers. We are in opposition of this House Bill 4094. You've heard great speeches for and against. I'll just not go down that path. I will tell you that in 1993, I was a cement mason apprentice, and not a soul. You know, I didn't have my own business. I worked for a contractor. I did have a disabling back injury at the time. Didn't know it. Just had a back injury. Was concerned, frightened, worried about how I was going to take care of my daughter, how I was going to keep the house afloat, how I was going to, you know, do all that. And SAFE came through and through all the guidelines and parameters, supplied me with money to keep going for that year, paid for the doctors, paid for the physical therapy. After a year, it was determined that I couldn't, I had a disabling injury, and I couldn't go back into that trade. I had to let go of that aspect of my life through some great actions. You know, I sit here and I can walk, and, you know, I played ball again. I've just surpassed what the doctor's initial diagnosis were. But had I not had the safety net of there's money coming in so you could feed the children, so you could, you know, pay the bills, and the long-term benefit of, you know, there's somebody watching out for me, I don't think that my story would end quite so in such a place. Again, you know, I'm a worker among workers. I didn't set out to start my own single-minded business, and, you know, I do have respect for sole proprietors. Sorry, you guys. I just want those parameters there for everybody. You know, simply put, you know, thank you for listening.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? All right. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate
your testimony. Anyone else here who didn't sign up who'd like to testify for or against this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I do need to enter into the record written testimony by Mr. John Doe, who is testified in favor of the measure.
Thank you. Thanks for all those who testified. I learned more than I knew before about workers' comp. And there being no business before the committee, additional business.
Before we adjourn, maybe a couple of comments, maybe?
Sure. Go ahead.
We appreciate everybody coming this Friday. Our goal, our co-chair goal, is to not do Fridays. At this point, we do not have next Friday scheduled. Not sure that we will be able to honor that, but we're going to try to do that.
Have you ever seen Frankenstein with the torches and the pitchforks?
Yeah.
And I appreciate those torches.
I love meeting.
And
Yeah, maybe we can arrange a special meeting.
I'm also 35 minutes from home, and these gentlemen are.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is our final deadline for posting is Monday at 3.
Is Monday the what?
Is Monday.
This Monday?
This Monday. Just to give you an idea of the pressure that we're under, and it's been quite a challenge to come up to speed on these bills.
We only have actually five meetings that we could really dabble with.
I think Monday would be our last. Monday would be our last day to pass out bills, a week from Monday.
Oh, a week? I thought you meant like
have a good week.
Day after tomorrow.
Monday, this coming Monday is the last day to post.
Yeah, throw away.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Jerry.
Thank you.